Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Mito Action's monthly expert series. Today, Dr. Oscar Henry Meyer, professor of clinical pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and attending pulmonologist at CHOP, is with us to share how to keep airways clear and breathing great, bulbar function, and respiratory muscles. My name is Stephanie Harry. I'm the patient support coordinator here at Mito Action and will be your host for today. Today's presentation will be recorded and available on MitoAction's website in the coming days, as well as on our podcast, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. We encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation using the Q&A feature on the bottom menu bar of your screen. The chat section is for you to talk with other families and clinicians who are in this space today, but it's really, really helpful if you can put all of your questions in the Q&A section, as that keeps me a little bit more organized and helps to make sure that we get through everyone's questions. Patients with progressive or static neuromuscular disease, and certainly mitochondrial disease, can have significant difficulty with airway clearance. This can be a problem on an everyday basis when a patient is well, but will become a much larger problem when a patient is acutely ill. We will discuss the link between bulbar upper airway function, respiratory muscle weakness, and airway clearance, and how to optimize airway clearance and lung health. Without further ado, I would like to introduce Dr. Oscar Henry Meyer. Dr. Meyer is a professor of clinical pediatrics at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and an attending pulmonologist within the Division of Pulmonology at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, also known as CHOP. He is the medical director of CHOP Pulmonary Function Testing and is actively involved in specialized care of patients with neuromuscular disease and complex chest wall and spinal deformity. He's been the pulmonologist in the Neuromuscular Center for the last 23 years and in the Center of Thoracic Insufficiency Syndrome since its inception 20 years ago. He is on a number of national committees and study groups involving pediatric pulmonary function testing and the assessment and management of children with complex thoracospinal disorders and neuromuscular disorders. He's lectured nationally and internationally and published over 90 journal articles and book chapters on his research and clinical interests. We are so, so excited to have you here today and really appreciate you coming and taking time to share your wisdom, understanding, and clinical experience with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. That makes me feel old, but it also makes me recognize I've had a lot of opportunities to learn from my patient interactions, and I'll hopefully be able to transmit a good portion of what I've learned to all of you today. Let me just go back to my first slide. I apologize. So as Stephanie said, I'm Hank Meyer. I'm a pediatric pulmonologist, and I've had a longstanding interest in managing patients with neuromuscular disease, irrespective of the type. And one of the things that I've also recognized from this is that there are general principles that govern a lot of the dysfunction that occurs. And so without further ado, we'll move on and we'll talk about the respiratory impact of bulbar or upper airway dysfunction. So these are my disclosures. I am a consultant and have been on advisory boards or lectured for a number of organizations here, none of which have any role in any of what's being presented today. So what I'd like to do is start by talking about bulbar dysfunction and why is it important to a pulmonologist and frankly to everybody, and then the impact of inadequate or dysfunctional bulbar function, and then how to support bulbar dysfunction, and then from that, talk about some management principles and challenges. And then we should have hopefully a good portion of time at the end to do questions and answers. So what is the importance of bulbar dysfunction? The upper airway, which I think of as including the back of the throat, the uvula going up to the nasopharynx, and then the vocal cords. It is important. It's effectively a bidirectional valve that controls both breathing and then swallowing. And I think of it as traffic control. And so here's a schematic of what happens. And really the three different aspects of the upper airway. Over on the left, what we have is the patient having taken a bite of something. So there's a bolus of food in the back of the throat between the tongue and the uvula. So in the process of swallowing, but the swallowing isn't happening because the epiglottis is up to close off the back of the throat, allowing air to go through the nose and into the trachea. Then, when the breath is over, the uvula will go upward and block off the nasopharynx, preventing any further air from coming in. Then the epiglottis closes over the trachea, as you can see there, allowing food to be shunted from the mouth into the esophagus, which is towards the back behind the trachea. And then when the bolus is down past the epiglottis, it opens up and then the patient can breathe again. So this requires high brain function. It's done automatically. You don't really have to think too much about it. But you do need to have both functional muscles and then functional neurologic communication between the brain and the posterior pharynx. So what the what this whole process does is a number of things. First and foremost, at least the purpose of this talk is the bulbar function helps to reduce the risk of aspiration. So it shunts things where they should go. And that includes both food and fluid intake, and then also processing native secretions from saliva and then from nasal secretions. All those drift to the back of the throat, and irrespective of whether you're eating for your primary nutrition or fed by G-tube, you still produce oronasal secretions, and they still need to be either suctioned, expectorated, or go down into the esophagus to be processed. The other thing that's necessary is having the ability to sense something in the back of the throat. And so if you sense material in the back of the throat, the posterior pharynx, one of the responses is you close your vocal cords, the epiglottis closes over them, and that material goes down into the esophagus, just like when you take something in by mouth. The other thing that's important in this is that bulbar function is important for a functional cough. And what we do when we cough is we take a big deep breath in and then breathe out forcefully. And for a fraction of a second, the vocal cords close, allowing pressure to build up in the lungs. And then when the vocal cords open, you have an expulsive flow of air up the respiratory tract. And so it involves much more than just taking a breath in and then breathing out forcefully. It's requires vocal cord function to produce a maximum cough, and so critical in removing material from the lungs. So if we talk further about the impact of inadequate bulbar function, there are two categories: above the glottis or above the vocal cords, and below the glottis. So, as I mentioned briefly in the previous slide, without adequate bulbar function, you're at risk of aspiration. And so we classify aspiration into two categories, micro and macro. Micro is small volume aspiration. It could be a little squirt of what you take into your mouth. It could be a little squirt of saliva. And it doesn't typically, just from a single event, cause problems. But you can have a cumulative impact over time that can lead to chronic inflammation. And we'll talk more about that later. Macro aspiration would be effectively a choking episode where you have a larger volume, single episode, or smaller volume, more than micro aspiration, and a higher number of episodes. That can cause acute lower respiratory tract obstruction. And then, depending on the material, you can have a vigorous inflammatory response. And if it's material such as from, the mixed in with upper airway bacteria, you can have that can be the nidus of an infection. Subglottically, when you have inadequate bulbar function, as I mentioned before, that can have a tremendous impact on your ability to cough and clear both material that's sort of forms in the lungs, such as an infection or airway mucus, but also aspirated material. So if you choke because of bulbar dysfunction, then you have the problem of not necessarily being able to effectively clear mucus or clear what you've aspirated. So it's sort of a double whammy. So, talking further about microaspiration, what it can present as is just persistent airway inflammation. And the severity of the inflammation is determined by what's aspirated. Acidic aspiration is much worse than non-acidic or sort of basic substances like milk. And that's worse than water, which milk obviously has proteins and other material in it that can cause some inflammation, whereas water is typically more benign but still not good. This chronic inflammation can initially, without doing much thought, be confused with asthma and treated unsuccessfully with inhaled steroids and then inhaled bronchodilators. And you can end up, because of the inflammation, irritating the mucosa, which then leads to mucus production. So you can have a sort of a wet chronic cough. You can, from that, have recurrent respiratory symptoms or illnesses, or have what would seem like a bronchitis or something, but not really with a fever to make you think that there's an acute illness, just sort of a chronic, indolent type of symptoms. Oftentimes, the diagnosis is made when somebody orders a chest CT scan. And what we see is what we call interstitial lung disease. And the interstitium is the tissue between the airways and the blood vessels. And that can become thickened because of inflammation. It can be focal, but typically, I'll show you where you're at risk of having aspiration in a few more slides. It can be focal, but it can also more likely be diffuse over a broader area. If it continues, then you can have airway damage and scarring, producing something called bronchiectasis, which adds further to airway clearance challenges, and that it effectively, in bronchiectasis, you denude the airway of the normal mucosa that has cilia that helps to bring mucus up the respiratory tract and out. And then, in addition, for, oftentimes patients that have microaspiration, because of the interstitial lung disease, will have a persistent supplemental oxygen requirement of maybe not a huge amount, but enough that would get you to question why it's there, which should then prompt you to go explore further. So evaluating microaspiration is a challenge because you're dealing with something that happens over a broad period of time. And so, what you need to do is first be suspicious. The assessment can be should be broad and fairly long term. And what we'll often do is look at symptoms. And if you have somebody that doesn't have multiple fevers and clear acute illnesses, then microaspirations could be a very likely outcome. One of the things we often will do is if we feel that it could be from reflux and then small volume aspiration of the refluxed material, which would be a very reasonable explanation in somebody that has bulbar dysfunction, then one of the approaches that we'll often take is to bypass the stomach. And if you have a gastric tube or a nasogastric tube, it can be passed through the stomach into the duodenum. So you can have a naso duodenal tube or a separate tube passed through the G tube into the duodenum. And what should happen over the span of perhaps a week is you should see a resolution of the symptoms that are produced because of the microaspiration. But it's important to recognize that if we're dealing with microaspiration, just treating gastroesophageal reflux is not adequate. And so that I say that because if the approach is to reduce the acid production in the stomach, which is typically the first line of therapy for gastroesophageal reflux, you're not reducing what's coming up, you're just making it less acidic. And so, to really see the impact of reflux, you have to completely stop reflux. And the simplest way is to bypass the stomach, at least I'd say make the nutrition that you're giving go past the stomach. So macro aspiration is a little bit easier. You have typically an acute event with an acute change, which can cause airway obstruction, can then lead to infection. And then oftentimes you can appreciate this on exam. And the location is kind of dependent on how the patient is positioned. If you're sitting upright, then if you think of the anatomy of the airway, the trachea is positioned downward going into the lungs. And so if you aspirate something, it's going to go downward into the lungs, into the lower lobes. If you happen to be lying on your back, then the dependent regions are a little different. It's the posterior regions of the lungs. The other aspect of this that we touched on a little bit earlier is that your risk of having significant problems from macro aspiration is dependent in part on how well you can cough and clear what you aspirate. So for those of us that have intact bulbar function and muscle function, if we choke on something, liquid, fluid, or solid, we're usually able to, with a few, maybe a half dozen, good strong coughs, clear what you aspirated, and then everything's fine. Our throat may hurt a little bit, but no further problems. If you don't have the ability to do that, then that aspiration event can lead to problems. So to evaluate for aspiration, macroaspiration, a chest X-ray is often diagnostic. But if it doesn't give you a clear idea of where things are a problem, then doing a chest CT scan to give a more three-dimensional and broader assessment is appropriate. And what we would look for would be loss of volume from atelectasis and mucus. Or mucus or secretion blockage, and potentially bronchiectasis, which would happen if there were repeated episodes. And again, that scarring of the airways that makes them dysfunctional. It's important to know because those dysfunctional airways can lead to further problems with further aspiration events. So this is an image of a child that actually had an aspiration event. And I just wanted to sort of walk you through. This is a CAT scan, so it's a cross-sectional representation of the chest. And we start from about a third of the way down the lungs at what we call the carina, where the airways split into from the trachea into right and left lower lobes. And so the way it's represented here, left is on the right, left lung is on the right, and the right lung is on the left. And as you go from the trachea on the top left image, you can see there's some splotchy white areas, and the density of those splotchy white areas increases as you go further down into the image on the bottom right, which has the it's well below the trachea, and that white spot in the middle, I'm sorry, that black spot in the middle is the esophagus, which happens to have some air in it. So you can see this patient was a baby, and the aspiration occurred when the baby was lying down. And so you can see that the preferential region of effect is the posterior region or the dependent region. So here's a cartoon of that. You can see the airway, general airway anatomy in the left image. And if you're lying down, you can see as mucus or debris goes down the airways, where it will land in the right lung and the left lung. In both situations, the material end up posteriorly and not necessarily in the lower lobe, at least on the right lung. So I want to move on to treatment strategies. So we know that there's bulbar dysfunction. How can we be proactive and aggressive when there is an event in management? So this is sort of a funny slide that I like to put in. And for situations like this, there's not a whole lot of hard fact and evidence to go on. And it's a lot of it is based on clinical judgment. And so this is a sort of a fake article that was published in the British Medical Journal a number of years ago. You can read through the title. It's effectively saying, we know that parachutes are helpful when you jump out of an airplane, but nobody's shown that it has an impact on trauma from jumping out of an airplane. So it's a nonsensical thing. And obviously you would never jump out of an airplane without a parachute. And I would argue that you should never go through life with bulbar dysfunction without a plan, though if we're looking for hard evidence, it's not always there. And so a lot of this is based on not so much trial and error, but an educated guess and discussion as to what approach should be taken. So let's get into this. How to support bulbar dysfunction? Well, first and foremost, if you know that there's aspiration, you need to ask questions about how we can reduce the risk of aspiration. If you're feeding by mouth and you're aspirating, then you may have to have a hard discussion about whether it's still safe to feed by mouth. One other aspect of that Stephanie and I were talking about before this started is involving a speech therapist, somebody who may be able to improve and maintain swallowing function. And so that would be the initial focus. And so we can reduce if we're not dealing with if we're not having nutrition by mouth, then minimizing the presence of upper airway secretions. So anybody can have allergies or increased nasal production. Salivation is something that goes into managing salivation is something that goes into managing bulbar dysfunction. We talked about gastroesophageal reflux. If you feel that it's active, it would be helpful from a mechanical standpoint to reduce it. And when I say mechanical standpoint, that's going beyond reducing the acidic content, but reducing the volume. And that could be bypassing the stomach. That could be using a prokinetic medicine to help the patient empty the stomach. Then the other thing is that if you have thick secretions that could be aspirated, you also want to make the secretions thinner and easier to clear. So one of the things that I like to think about is when we talk about swallowing dysfunction, it's not always the complete absence, but it can be under, let's say, a dysfunctional but still partially functional swallowing. And what I mean by that is you could have somebody that has adequate bulbar function or swallowing to clear normal volumes of upper airway secretions, meaning nasal secretions and saliva. However, if that person then has increased secretion volume during an illness, or perhaps if they have allergies, if there's increased nasal secretion from allergies, then they may run into a problem. And so both managing the secretions is important, but also seeing if you can improve function. The other thing that can be done is that, if there's no way to improve swallowing, then what you can also do is augment it by using suctioning. And one of the discussions I'll often have with the patients, I'd say a family of my patients, is whether the additional support that they give by doing oral nasal suctioning is manageable. Is it too frequent? Is it at a level where they can barely leave their child's side to go into the kitchen and get a glass of water? And so a lot of this is sort of a practical quality of life question. And then the other thing is for removing material from the lungs once it's aspirated, there are techniques that we'll talk about a little later for augmenting cough to help bring up material. So for reducing the risk of aspiration, we can address both oral and nasal secretions. And that can include making thin secretions less prominent. But that also means making them thick, and so that can that's an issue that needs to be thought of when we're going through this. And the typical approach is to use something called an anticholinergic medicine, and those medicines help to decrease fluid production and secretions. And that includes medicines such as glycopyrrolate, which goes by the trade name of QCOSA, and then atropine drops, and then there's a medicine called scopolamine that comes as a patch. All three of those can be used successfully, depending on what depending on having a good plan for reducing nasal secretions. One approach is to dry them up using something like oxymetolazine, which is under the trade name of Afrin. Anybody can have allergies, so an antihistamine can be helpful. And then nasal steroids can be helpful also to reduce nasal inflammation and secretion production. The other thing is salivation. If you have reflux, one of the feedbacks that are, one of the mecha, I'm sorry, one of the things that happens is that if you have reflux of material up into the esophagus, even before it gets into the back of the throat, that can produce saliva. And to prove this, just think about the last time we all vomited. Before you vomit, as material is sort of coming up through the esophagus, you start to salivate. And so if you have recurrent reflux of any material in the stomach, that will produce saliva. The other thing is that if you have a child that is doing oral stimulation, that contact in the mouth can also produce saliva. And so those are two mechanisms that, if addressed, could produce, I'm sorry, could reduce saliva production without directly doing that with an anticholinergic. And the reason that's important is that adds a level of safety in terms of not shifting from high secretion volume to normal and then to low secretion volume, but thick secretions that are hard to clear. So, to a certain extent, using medicines in this way can be a fool's errand. And what I mean by that is we have a physical dysfunction. The body is a dynamic, as a combination of a bunch of dynamic processes. And so to be able to use medicines to completely and effectively recreate those functions is very, very difficult. And to assume that you can do it perfectly is truly a fool's errand. But it doesn't mean that it's not worth a try. But what it does mean is that you just have to stay on your toes. And so one of the things that we have to do is identify what's optimal. Are we trying to do to make things perfect or make them manageable? And if we strive for perfection, it can be a challenge. But if we strive for optimal, optimal could be no hospitalizations during an illness. It could be not having a child choking. And also being able to take a situation where there's increased secretions and easily remove them. So, whatever approach you take, it can't be a static approach. It needs to be dynamic. There needs to be the ability to escalate, such as during an acute illness, and then de-escalation at the right time when the secretions, or I'm sorry, the symptoms caused by the acute illness are going away. And if you don't de-escalate at the right time, then what can happen is that you can shift from problem of high volume secretions to low volume thick secretions that are hard to clear. The other thing that's important is knowing when to escalate. So knowing when you're beginning to get sick, when you're beginning to have increased secretions. And then the other thing related to this that we've talked about is trying to minimize the side effects. Anticholinergic medicines dry secretions or decrease production. You can overdry. If you're using an anticholinergic, you can also get urinary retention. And I've had some patients where that's been an intolerable side effect. And so that's important to keep in mind. And then if you overdry the mucosa, then you can end up getting mucosal trauma and bleeding and adherent secretions, which is certainly no good. And then obviously, if you thicken secretions, they can be harder to clear. One approach that we use and have in our have families have in their back pocket is if you feel like you've overdone the I'm sorry, drying secretions, and secretions are a little thick, you can hydrate them by using nebulized normal saline, or in the nose, you can actually squirt in some saline to make the mucus thinner and easier to clear. So the other approach, obviously, is to try and improve function, improve swallowing function by engaging with speech therapy, so that you can handle both a normal secretion volume and then have a better opportunity to manage a higher increased secretion volume. And then obviously we talk some about removing secretions with suctioning, and then making sure that you have a safe feeding regimen, and are putting, if you're bypassing the upper airway, is identify what the optimal site is for offering feedings, whether it's a G tube or a gastric jejunal tube. So the other thing is supporting clearing or coughing and clearing secretions. And when you cough, there are really three distinct phases. One phase has sort of two parts to it, but the first is that you take a big deep breath in and then you forcefully exhale. And the second part of that is your vocal cords close for a fraction of a second. And what that gives you is the opportunity to increase pressure in the airway, the vocal cords open up, and you have an expulsive flow of air up the respiratory tract carrying secretions. So if you have an absence of either of these, then you're going to have inadequate airway clearance. And so if you have bulbar dysfunction, obviously you don't have normal glottic function, and your vocal cords may not be able to close completely and effectively during a cough. So I've mentioned already what happens when you cough. This is sort of a pictorial representation. So big breath in. Start to exhale against a closed vocal cords. The vocal cords open, and then secretions and debris comes up and out the respiratory tract. So there are some ways of defining a normal cough. And so a guy named John Bach, who's a physical medicine and rehab doc from Northern New Jersey, and he really revolutionized the way that we look at airway clearance. And so he actually studied patients, adult patients with neuromuscular disease, and showed that before extubation or removing a breathing tube, what predicted a successful extubation, which requires cough, is to be able to produce a flow with coughing of over 160 liters per second. And then subsequently, others have shown that if that number is above 270 when you're well, that when you're sick and you become weaker, you should still be able to maintain a normal cough and clearance. So a lot of this work was done in adults, and so it's a little hard to know how much to apply it to the pediatric population, but we still use these values if we want to get a clear idea of whether somebody has an effective cough. So the way I screen for coughing is in sort of the real world, and I ask questions related to how long an illness occurs. So if you get a cold, normal colds for those of us that have intact muscles and bulbar function should be maybe 3 to 7 days. If you have colds that are lasting well beyond that, so let's say that you have a cough that's half effective, then it's going to take twice as long to get over your cold. So for a 7 day cold, that would be 14 days. If it's even less than 50% effective, then you can be talking about 2 to 3 weeks. And so if you have lingering cold symptoms, that makes me very concerned about cough effectiveness. And then with that, I would want to figure out how to better support the patient. So we can supplement airway clearance by helping the patient breathe in more deeply, breathe out more forcefully, doing both, and then there are also some adjunctive measures that can be complementary. So you can help the patient breathe in more deeply, and this is a device that's called an intermittent positive pressure breaths, and it's effectively a compressor that gives a series of breaths to synchronize when a patient's breathing in, so it helps them breathe in more deeply. As you breathe in more deeply, you expand the lungs, which expand the airways, which gives you the opportunity to get air behind mucus that might be plugging airways. And then as you get more air behind mucus, then as you cough, it's easier to, with that air, push the secretions out and up the respiratory tract. You can also do this non-mechanically by doing what we call breath stacking, which is where you take a mask over the mouth and nose. And I think I have an image of this coming up. And you allow a you ask a patient to take a breath in, and then they don't breathe out, and then they take another breath and don't breathe out. So you stack breaths until their lungs are full. Then you remove the mask and have them breathe out as hard as they can. So you augment their inspiration. There's another way of doing this called glossopharyngeal breathing, which may be hard in bulbar dysfunction, but in patients that have intact bulbar function, you use the throat muscles to push air into the lungs. It takes a lot of teaching, and I certainly have I don't have the expertise to do this, and so I typically don't do this. But I mention this because it is available, and trained physiotherapists can teach patients how to do this. So the image over on the left is a breath stacking device, and so there's a red arrow on the right part of that image, which allows, it's a one-way valve allowing air in. The patient breathes that air in, and then the device over on the left with the two black arrows has a one-way valve that is actuated at a high pressure. So you have to really breathe out hard to get the air out. And so that allows the patient to breathe in, but not out. The device in the middle is something called a mechanical anisocinator or cough assist. This particular device has been around for a while and now is not being produced anymore. There are two other devices that now are available to do cough assist. And then the IPPB device is over to the right. So you can use a cough assist device just to do breath in, but we typically use it to do a breath in and then a breath out. So, for expiratory assistance, there are non-mechanical approaches. This is doing a mechanically assisted cough, and the two images on the top are at rest when you're asking the patient to breathe in, and then their hands on the chest, and then hands on the chest and abdomen. The lower two images are augmenting coughing, so doing a mechanically assisted cough by pressing on the chest or pressing on the chest and abdomen as the patient is breathing out to augment exhalation. So this is a study that was done looking at augmenting cough just by doing expiratory assistance. And so the values I give here are peak cough flow. And if you remember, 160 was sort of the threshold that got people concerned, but it's really 270 when well. And so what you can see here in patients with muscular dystrophy or spinal muscular atrophy or muscle weakness or nerve related abnormality, you can see that the unassisted peak cough flow, so their ability to cough and clear, is low, but increases substantially when you do either compression on the chest, which is thoracic mechanically assisted cough, or compression of the chest and abdomen. So just augmenting exhalation can be very, very effective. What we typically do is we augment inspiration and then exhalation, doing either breath stacking or a manual assisted cough, or using something like a cough assist device. And so when we do the cough assist, we do a series of cycles of inspiration and exhalation, and we set a pressure that's applied for. It says 1 to 2 minutes. It's 1 to 2 seconds. I apologize. And then we shift to exhalation, also at 15 to 50 centimeters of water, depending on what is the appropriate pressure for the patient. So do back and forth 5 times, pause, suction, or if the patient's able to expectorate, then they go ahead and do that. And then we typically do 5 sets. For many of these devices, you can do an oscillation or a vibratory treatment while you're doing this, though it's unclear how much of an impact that has. Now, the typical approach, as I said, is 5 sets of 5 breaths, but I don't think there's a person here that only coughs 25 times when they need to cough and clear mucus. Instead, what we do is we give parents and caregivers the latitude to decrease or increase the number of breaths, I'm sorry, the number of coughs, and also the frequency based on what the need is. And so, last thing I'll point out here, the cough assist, the original modern one is in the top right. And again, that's not being produced anymore. The two that are called the Sinclara and the Biways, both of which are very, very effective. So just to be complete, I wanted to point out the options there. So this is a study looking at the effectiveness of doing both inspiratory and expiratory assistance. And so if we look here over on the left, that's a peak cough flow for somebody with neuromuscular disease, just doing the best they can, doing a cough. So you can see it's well below the 160 and even further below the 270 liter per minute threshold. And then with a manually assisted cough, you have an increase in peak cough flow. And then if you just augment inspiration with breath stacking, you can see that you have another nice increase. But if you do them both together, you have a fairly dramatic and significant increase in peak cough flow, such that the mean population is up to about, the mean of the population is up to about 270 liters per minute. This is pretty much the same done from another group. This is looking at unassisted coughing on the left, and then manually assisted cough using a ventilator or a BiPAP unit to take a breath, and then also exsufflation doing a manual insufflation, and then doing both insufflation and exsufflation together on the far right. And that biphasic augmenting inspiration and exhalation is the only treatment that had a significant increase in peak cough flow over what the patient was able to do unassisted. Obviously, showing that you need to do something, and the optimal approach is to augment both inspiration and exhalation. So, I want to finish the treatment part by talking about making mucus easier to clear, which we call mucus mobilization. There are ways to do that by physiotherapy, doing something called intrapulmonary percussive ventilation, which is essentially a fancy nebulizer done under pressure with oscillation. You can also get a similar effect with something called the vest, which was developed for patients with cystic fibrosis. And this is external vibration that helps to thin mucus and make it easier to clear. Both of these require an intact cough. So without a cough, either your native cough or a cough from using the cough assist, the mucus doesn't come out. Just makes it easier to clear. You can use medicines such as hydrating agents like normal saline, 3%, 7%, or 10% saline. The 7 and 10% saline was from work done in cystic fibrosis, as was using these two mucolytics, which help to break up mucus. The first is Pulmozyme, which breaks up cellular components of mucus, and then N-acetylcysteine, which breaks up bonds between mucus molecules. This is what the home version of IPV looks like. It's sometimes hard to get approved because there's not, as I said, I was talking about earlier, there's not clear evidence that it works. There's a lot of empiric evidence that it works. And so that little nuance there is often an off-ramp for a payer to take to not pay for IPV, though usually with persistence and a good cogent argument, we can get it approved. This is what the vest looks like. And again, this is indicated for patients with cystic fibrosis, but can also be a way of helping to mobilize mucus and make it easier to clear. So I want to finish by talking about how to support the patient. Let's put this all together. So from a pharmacologic standpoint, we can use medicines to control mucus production in the upper airway, decongestants, antihistamines. There are ways to decrease saliva production. So we mentioned the anticholinergics such as glycopyrrolate and atropine, and then scopolamine. Beyond that, you can do botulinum toxin injections to the salivary glands and then actually remove the salivary glands. And then, as mentioned earlier, the idea is to create a model that is manageable, both safe and is sustainable for you as the caregiver at home. And the other thing is to be able to be as dynamic as possible, to do escalation and then decrease in pharmacologic management, and to not just add on more medicines, to make sure that what you're using is still important. Then ultimately, you want to maximize quality of life, improving medical stability, reducing the risk of infection, optimizing the ability to speak, removing excess secretions in the upper airway, and preventing drooling. And a lot of this is really based on the parental assessment and the patient assessment of how things are going. So, with that, I'll conclude and look forward to. I'll stop sharing here and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much. We've absolutely had a lot of questions coming through, filtering through. And so this really gives us a wonderful base to be able to start talking about bulbar function and treatments for it. One of the questions that came through is if a child has lost the ability to cough due to muscular related issues and they're using a cough assisted device, can this device or some of the other devices that you mentioned, can it enable for function to return? Like, is there a way, like, or once you've had loss, are you just trying to maintain the cough? Does that make sense?
Yeah, so just to be clear, the cough assist doesn't help with coughing. It does the coughing. And so it re replaces absent function or inadequate function. Unfortunately, it does not make the cough better. It just replaces it. So it's not really a device that's used for training. So to that end, there are a number of options available if you have the ability to regain function or want to try and preserve function. And progressive neuromuscular disease for patients that are able to follow directions reliably, we can do inspiratory and expiratory muscle training. So, just like if you want to get stronger, stronger legs or stronger arms, you can do strength training. Well, we can do strength training for the inspiratory and expiratory muscles. And these devices look like sort of whistles that, something you make bubbles with, but it has a resistor in it. And so you can set that up to do both inspiratory and expiratory muscle training. And then, as I mentioned a few times, I feel very, very strongly about engaging with speech therapy to work on trying to maintain bulbar function and, to the extent possible, try and improve that. And again, the throat itself, the upper airway, it's a muscle. It's a muscle tube. And so there are ways to try and strengthen that muscle or improve function.
So you would talk to your respiratory therapist about about strengthening those particular muscles, and then
Yeah.
you would talk to the speech therapist in regards to the swallowing component. Is that
Exactly.
what do you know? I know you're not a speech therapist, but what do they do? Like, well, how do the speech therapists help with the swallowing component? Do they have strength training, like you were kind of talking about for for your swallowing as well, or how do they approach that?
I think a lot of times it's a coordination issue. And so what they can do is they can do they can teach you sort of the stimulation skills that can help a patient coordinate a swallow. You can do things like sipping through a straw that should help to improve your bulbar muscle function or strength, I'm sorry. So I think it's a combination of those two things. And then sometimes it's just it's sort of the general thought and muscle function is that if you don't use it, you lose it. And so one of the challenges is that if you it's been determined that you or your child aren't safe to swallow for nutritive value and you shift to G-tube feedings, you cannot close down the whole bulbar speech therapy aspect of things. That's where I think a lot of times things can go south because you're allowing weak muscles to get weaker because you're not using them. And so if you engage with a speech therapist, they should be able to put together a protocol for, at the very least, trying to maintain the function that you have and perhaps improving the function that you have. I wish I could quote you on what exactly that is, but that's beyond my expertise.
No, but that's really helpful because there was a patient that asked the question, their child is G-tube fed and but can drink water but cannot eat food, and they were kind of wondering, they're concerned about bulbar function, and so they don't know, like, where do you start? So, like, if you don't see a speech therapist at this point, if your child is G-tube fed, and you're concerned about making sure that some of those other muscles are still functioning or still, like, that you can kind of strengthen that, where do you even start? Like, do you start with your PCP and ask to see a speech therapist? Do you start with your mito specialist, your metabolic doctor, and ask to do you start with your pulmonologist and say, hey, I'm so concerned about this. Can you refer me? How does that work?
So the speech therapist that you would very likely get out in the community would be somebody that would probably be more equipped to deal with vocalization issues. My initial recommendation would be to engage with a specialty care center, a place where your neuromuscular team or your mitochondrial physician practices, and the speech therapist there may be more equipped to handle this level of therapy. Speech therapists all go through the same training, and they just then kind of choose what direction they want to go. If a speech therapist in the community says, "Oh yeah, in my training, I learned how to do this. I don't do it very often, but I know how to do it. I can help you." Then I think that's going to be perfectly fine, and you can see what type of results you get. But if you don't get a good sense of confidence and comfort with what the speech therapist is offering, then obviously you probably need to look elsewhere. And unfortunately, that may limit access for people that don't live in a major metropolitan area, but at the very least, this is something where, unlike seeing your pulmonologist or neuromuscular doctor, you don't necessarily need to do regular checkups. You can have an assessment, and then you can have a treatment protocol put in place that you can follow up on. And this is something that, if they're willing, could also work very well with virtual visits. Don't need to, unlike me as a pulmonologist, I need to put my stethoscope on you to do a proper exam. Don't necessarily need to do that as a speech therapist, at least for follow-up.
It's really helpful, and it's really helpful to understand that, speech therapists have different paths, because you might, our community might be more familiar with certain paths of speech therapy than others. So it's good to keep that in the back of our mind as we're trying to find a speech therapist to help with some of these bulbar issues. Another patient asks, can IPBB be used for routine maintenance of neuromuscular lung disease? And additionally, can it be used post-surgery?
So I would say yes, sort of, and yes, sort of. So what I mean by that is what IPPB does is it increases air going into the lungs. So that can be very helpful in preventing lung collapse, what we call atelectasis, which is one of the mechanisms of loss of lung function in any progressive neuromuscular condition. So it's not going to strengthen any muscles or improve muscle function. It's going to improve lung function effectively, making the lung mechanics a little better by preventing collapse and making the lungs easier to move. Post-operatively, it can be very helpful also. There's an approach called lung volume recruitment, which is, as the name implies, recruiting lung volume. And it's absolutely critical after surgery. And for those of us that have intact respiratory muscles, if you've had surgery, you'll know that they put a really annoying device called an incentive spirometer at your bedside. And they say every 10 minutes, you have to get up and blow into this for 5 minutes. And what you're doing with that is it's encouraging you to take deeper breaths, which helps to re-expand your lungs. And so it is an important part of just sort of general lung maintenance, and something we try very hard to implement early on, either IPPB or more usually what we'll do is a cough assist device, because we know that if it's a progressive neuromuscular condition, at some point the cough isn't going to be adequate. And I'd much rather have a cough assist device already in the home when that happens, so that we can easily pivot to using it.
Another question that came in is they were curious if you knew if pulmonary hypertension is related to mito, and if so, does it have specific treatment?
Well, I don't know the answer about, well, I don't know if it, if there's something specific about mitochondrial dysfunction and pulmonary hypertension, but there's definitely a link between chronic hypoxemia, low oxygen from whatever the source, and pulmonary hypertension. And in terms of treatment, if pulmonary hypertension is present, obviously the first approach is to try and manage any mitigating factors such as respiratory insufficiency or hypoxemia. So there's a pulmonary aspect to that. The other part is that there are plenty of medicines that have been used that are used to try and relax the pulmonary vessel tone to make pulmonary hypertension easier, better managed, and less of a problem.
So you mentioned different oral treatments to reduce aspiration. I'm going to mispronounce them if I try to say the three that you mentioned, but I'm curious if you could explain a little bit about how they work, the
Glycopyrrolate. Okay.
and the atropine
Yeah.
and
So glycopyrrolate, atropine, and scopolamine are all what we call anticholinergic medicines. And the cholinergic system, among the things that it does when it's stimulated, is it produces secretions. excuse me. It also produces, helps with motility in the gut and then in the bladder, in the urinary system. And so, if you block that aspect of things or reduce that in the body with one of those three medicines, then you can reduce saliva production, reduce secretion production, but you also can decrease stomach emptying, intestinal motility, and then bladder motility, which is why you can sometimes run into problems with that. Excuse me. And so it is, as I mentioned earlier, when I used the term fool's errand to say that, like, we can treat an infection, then it's gone. Treating over secretion, sorry, trying to reduce secretion production. That's not a once and done thing, or something where you start a medicine and keep it at one dose. It's something that can change widely, and that's why it's important if you do choose to go that route that you have a plan for escalation and then de-escalation, even more importantly.
And that you stay in touch with your pulmonologist, it sounds like. So there was a patient who asked. They mentioned that they have a chronic wet cough and voice issues, and so they got an X-ray done, and the pulmonologist said based on the X-ray that everything looked clear. But if you're still having symptoms and you've not had it sounds like you mentioned that the CT scan might be, the best way to make sure. Like if there's still like question in your mind, like would the next step be to talk with them about possibly getting a CT scan? Is that, or if you've gotten the X-ray and it looks good, there's no need to go to the next step if you're still having symptoms? How do you?
Well, if the symptoms are just, I feel like I have secretions, and not, I have low oxygen, or, my energy has changed out of character with where my disease is, then the approach that I would take in that situation would be to, talk about the opportunity to cough better. Get a cough assist if you or advocate for getting a cough assist or getting or nasal suctioning. So think about being in the dentist's office. Have the tooth cleaning, they give you a little bit of water, and then they have that suction device that you swirl the water around, and then you put the suction catheter in your mouth and everything comes out. The same thing can happen here. So to try and clear upper airway secretions that just aren't coming out with the cough that you have, my recommendation would be to increase the cough effectiveness. And if I had a patient with neuromuscular disease with those complaints, that's what my approach would be.
Okay, that's really helpful. Do you know if there is any way to stimulate a swallow reflex manually?
Well, speaking as a non-trained speech therapist, the general approach that I understand is oral stimulation. And that can be not putting something all like a tongue depressor to the back of the throat to make somebody gag, but I think to stimulate the sides of the back of the throat. And that can sort of effectively trigger a swallow in terms of, and it can also frankly trigger a cough, whatever cough you still have.
So I know you've kind of answered this question, but I want to ask you more broadly in case there's something because it was like more specific in an earlier question that you didn't cover. A patient asked, "How can you improve bulbar function? What would make bulbar function fluctuate?" So I don't know if that triggers your brain in a different way to re
If we go back to the statement I made earlier that essentially the throat is a muscle tube. There are a variety of different muscles as part of that. And so you can strengthen muscle or make muscle work better by using it. And so what I mean by that is doing something to actually produce a if you have no you're not using swallowing for anything other than clearing secretions, then you can do things to trigger a swallow and make the muscles contract and work better. In terms of, I mentioned that there are ways that we have to make the breathing muscles work better or get stronger by doing certain breathing maneuvers. I don't know of what that would be for bulbar function. And some of it can also be, having a speech therapist start back in doing swallowing of liquids or solids. We're one of the, this is actually something that's of interest now in the spinal muscular atrophy community, which many of you may know there are a number of medicines that have been shown to be very effective. And so there's an approach, a focus in not just adding on treatment to replace what's weak, but to look at ways of improving function. And one of those is by doing speech therapy. I wish I could give you a better answer. I kind of talked around in a circle there because I just don't I don't know that I can give you anything better than that right now.
No, I think that's super helpful. I think it's a starting place. And as with most questions, right, when we answer, start to answer one question, we have three more. So I think that's a really helpful starting place. This is kind of pivoting a little bit, but what is the role of a BiPAP in neuromuscular lung disease? And what are the indications for adding that at night?
Just in terms of precision, I wouldn't call it neuromuscular lung disease. It effectively is a muscle disease, so muscle failure, respiratory muscle failure. So lungs themselves should be perfectly fine. So BiPAP or bilevel positive airway pressure is only effective or really useful if you have respiratory failure. And what I mean by that is an inability to bring in either the oxygen you need or get rid of the carbon dioxide your body's producing. And that first happens at night and first at night in deep REM sleep. And where it can be helpful in any neuromuscular condition is, at least in the early stage, is to improve sleep. And the way that happens is that if you're sleeping and you're in deep sleep and you are struggling to bring in the oxygen your body needs or get rid of the carbon dioxide your body produces, those two will become abnormal. The good thing is that your body has very sensitive receptors in a couple of locations to sense when the oxygen level or the carbon dioxide level is not normal, and then tell you to breathe better. And what that effectively is going from deep sleep to less deep sleep or awakening, and then things normalize. The problem is that that means that you're not sleeping in deep sleep very much, and so you don't get the same restorative benefit of sleep that you would if you slept perfectly well. So if you have that problem and you start on non-invasive ventilation, bi-level positive airway pressure, then that cycle of falling to deep sleep and then awakening or arousing goes away and you sleep well. And so that means that you also have the opportunity to rest and recover from the stress of your day. So in any condition with or without neuromuscular disease, it's absolutely critical in optimizing function.
So, if you have, so one of the questions that came through is a patient that has mito, and they were curious about for mito patients if they have pneumonia, they're kind of making the assumption that it's probably going to be harder to recover from. And so then their question is there, this is a hard question too. I think, like, is there an average time frame of oxygen use for like a mito patient versus a patient that doesn't have like an underlying condition, after they've had a bout of pneumonia.
Well, I would look at it. Well, let's start with why, when you're sick and you have a pneumonia, do you need supplemental oxygen?
Okay.
And the simple answer is it's an indication of debris in your airways. The debris here would be the infection, not just the bacteria, but all the white blood cells that stream to the bacteria or virus, fungus, whatever infection you have, and kill it. And what happens is the white blood cells go there, they do their bit, and then they themselves die. And so you end up in an infection having lots of mucus. You have to get rid of all of that. And during that process of getting rid of the mucus, if you fall behind a little bit, then you have secretions in the airway. And what happens is that you're not getting enough air going into the blood through the lungs because you have plugged off airways. And so the answer to the question is kind of dependent on, well, it's not kind of, it is dependent on how severe the pneumonia is. And so it's really hard to say, other than that, if you have mitochondrial disease, it'll take you longer than obviously somebody with intact muscle function to recover. The other variable, of course, is how severe is the infection. If you have just a basic cold and you catch it early, you may not have any difficulty. Whereas if you have a particularly bad infection, be it bacterial or viral, your immune system could be overwhelmed and your lungs could be impacted quite dramatically, perhaps requiring mechanical ventilation. But during that time, the other critical part is very aggressive airway clearance. And airway clearance effectively with a cough assist, or if you have an intact cough, is how the secretions get out, which then determines how long it takes for the oxygen to recover.
Thank you so much. That's really, really helpful. I promise we're going to try to wrap things up. We still have
No
questions
problem.
coming through.
Yeah.
A patient asked, and this is, I know this is specific, so I know you have to answer it kind of broadly, but I think there's an important question in here. She asked, what is the benefit of IPBB versus a BiPAP? My daughter's pulmonologist has told us that she will require a BiPAP at night eventually. She was diagnosed with neuromuscular weakness based off of a PFT. Her MIP and MEP were 27% and 29%. He's mentioned cough assist devices, but not mentioned IPBB. So then, circling back around, the original question was, what is the benefit of IPB versus BiPAP?
All right, so let me answer it in two categories. If we're
Okay.
talking about it for airway clearance, I never use IPPB because I feel that exhalation pressure, helping with with breathing out with the cough is equally important. Some would argue even more important than how deeply you breathe in. And so, if the MIP and the MEP are as low as they are, both the inspiratory and expiratory muscle needs to be supported. And with IPPB, you're just supporting the inspiratory muscle, breathing in more deeply. So, in general, I would go right to using a mechanical annexoflator or cough assist device. In terms of the other aspect of this is IPPB was originally developed as a ventilator. It gives you a deeper breath. But if you're ventilating somebody that has neuromuscular disease, you need two pressures. You need that pressure that gets the air in and helps you breathe in more deeply, and then a pressure that helps to keep air in the lungs in between a breath. That's the expiratory pressure. And so BiPAP, bilevel positive airway pressure, has that inspiratory pressure and then that expiratory pressure. And it's important because if you have muscle weakness, the lungs can sometimes deflate below the volume where the airways stay open, or said differently, the airways can close as you breathe out in patients with neuromuscular disease. So we always like to have a little pressure in the airway in between breaths so that the airways stay open.
This question that just came through, it might be that combo of where you're working as a respiratory therapist with the speech therapist. So they gave an example that their daughter has Lee's disease, and has very thick mucus and saliva, which causes them to gag and throw up. And so the speech therapy hasn't been as helpful. As a pulmonologist, how would you work with this speech therapist, or would you then progress to a different treatment as a pulmonologist to help prevent the throwing up component?
I'm sorry, the throwing out component.
Yeah, they're gagging and throwing up on their mucus, and the swallowing and tongue exercises that is given is not helping at this point. So do you, like, at that point, do you have suggestions as to what route you go?
Well, it sounds like there's gagging involved. If, you think about if you have something caught in the back of your throat, whether it's, a little bit of dried mucus or you swallowed something and it stuck back there and you cough, 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 then you oftentimes will end up gagging. And if you have something in your stomach, that gag becomes vomiting. And so the approach that I would take is to try and prevent things getting to the point of gagging. And if it's, I have secretions in the back of my throat and they're hard to get out, I would, in that situation, use nebulized normal saline to try and condition the airway, humidify secretions, and understand that what you're doing by that is we talked about mucus hydration earlier, and that means pulling fluid into mucus to make it thinner and easier to clear. And it's sort of like what happens when, if you have a chest cold or just have increased secretions and you take your evening or morning shower, in the 5 or 10 minutes you might be in there and breathing that humid air, that humidifies the mucus and then makes it easier to clear. And so you can do that by using normal saline by nebulizer. That would be my thought. I don't know that there's a way that you can suppress a gag. I certainly can't. If I'm gagging, I'm gagging. But I think it's the role I would take would be more preventative than trying to. I just don't think there's a way to stop it once it starts. So I would do things to try and soothe the throat, and then also humidify the mucus to perhaps make it easier to clear so that you're not dealing with something caught in the back of your throat.
So I want you to know that there have been lots and lots of thank yous throughout the chat, throughout the
Oh, you're
question box
welcome.
too. Just really appreciative of all of the wisdom and advice that you've been able to give to patients and their families. And one of the patients asked, and I think this is maybe a good space to end, but they're a parent, and they are watching their child decline and trying to understand if they're red flags. And so this is kind of a broad general question, but like as parents, if you know that there's bulbar issues, or as a patient yourself, if you know that there are some bulbar issues, what are some red flags that you would encourage patients that, like, maybe they should let the respiratory therapist know. If you see this, make sure that you get in contact with your respiratory therapist. Or if you have kind of stopped seeing your respiratory therapist, but you were seeing them for bulbar function issues at some point, get back in touch with your respiratory therapist if you see this.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. And the answer that I would give is two things. One, let's say you choke on something, you're drinking, or you have something in the back of your throat and you choke. We all have that happen. And for those of us with intact muscle strength, it may take a few good coughs and to bring up the fluid that you may have aspirated. If it's taking significantly more than that, or to the point where you're talking about a minute of coughing and you're understandably getting concerned, that would be a reason to intervene. The other would be, we talked about duration of a cold. If you have a cold and it's gone from, oh yeah, they usually 5 to 7 days, now it's 15 days, 2 weeks to 3 weeks, then that would make me very concerned. Even if you've never started an antibiotic or never needed to, go for a sick visit or to the emergency room or have had a pneumonia, if you're having an increase in the duration of just regular garden variety colds, that could be a sign of coughing. I'm sorry, of bulbar dysfunction causing problems with coughing. And so for the sort of the first scenario, suctioning, I'm sorry, choking, when you're drinking or eating, in that situation, in addition to the cough assist, having suctioning available can be very helpful. So that if you can get something up to the back of the throat, you can then get it out delicately with suctioning. And then, obviously the cough assist would help, bring out, would help, to augment coughing during an acute illness or if you happen to aspirate.
Thank you so much, Dr.
You're welcome.
Meyer. I just really, really appreciate your time and your willingness to break down this conversation and answer all of these really important questions. And we really appreciate your time and your wisdom, and look forward to continuing to stay in touch.
Sure. Very good. Thanks for your attention. Happy to participate in the discussion.
And again, to our audience and friends, just know that this is recorded. So if you want to go back and revisit the items that were discussed, it will be posted here next week. Thank you again for attending, and we look forward to seeing you next month.
All right, very good.